Hello and welcome back to Film Weekly. I'm Jason Solomons. On the show this week, we revisit an icon in French and world cinema. Yes, this week sees the 50th anniversary big screen, a digitally restored re-release of Jean-Luc Godard's classic A Bout de Souffle. That's breathless to you. To discuss its creation and influence, I'll be joined by one of the team that actually made this masterpiece, Pierre Rission. On the show last week, I promised you more from the Edinburgh International Film Festival. It closes this Saturday night with a British film called Third Star. Its director, Hattie Dalton, joins me to discuss her tale of discovery, loss and death. And Guardian film editor Andrew Pulver will be along to help me review some of this week's other releases, including Woody Allen and Larry David in Whatever Works and Isabelle Huppert in Villa Amalia. Yes, it's got it way more together than the French football team. It's a breathless edition of Film Weekly.
New York Herald Tribune!
C'est en croix, hein?
C'est gentil. Qu'est-ce que vous faites ici? C'est que vous détestez Paris.
J'ai pas dit que je détestais, j'ai dit que j'avais beaucoup d'ennemis.
Ah, the wonderful voices of Gene Seberg and Jean-Paul Belmondo there in Jean-Luc Godard's Breathless, which gets a polish and a re-release onto the big screen this week, 50 years after it first broke the mould. The film is without doubt the most influential work to have come out of the French New Wave, maybe out of cinema altogether. It stole back the flame of cinematic innovation from America and put European sophistication, sex and cool forever in the film lexicon. Any excuse to discuss this fine work is a good thing, but it's even better when you have in your presence someone who was intimately involved in its creation. Pierre Rission was assistant director on A Bout de Souffle, and I'm delighted to say that he joins me in the Film Weekly studio now. You're touched by legend being associated with the 50 years of A Bout de Souffle. Can you believe that it's 50 years?
No, because I still feel young in my heart, maybe not in my body, but young in my heart. And also the picture has always been young, you know, all these 50 years, it was always young.
Yes.
You know, the few times I saw it again and again and again, maybe, I don't know, 7, 8 times according to some cities, some circumstances. And recently, actually, very recently, in an interview like yours, I happened to say spontaneously that not only it's a young film, but it's a happy film, you know. And I never thought of it before. I thought of it subconsciously, but I never thought to express it that way. But when it came a few days ago, because the picture is issued in Paris also, when I said it was a happy film, I think it was true.
So you say you knew Jean-Luc Godard.
Yeah.
How did you become involved? How come he asked you to be in his film?
You know, when I started to be a young film buff, and I was, as probably you know about me, I was a very young, very ardent film buff. Jean-Luc Godard was not in Paris. He was in South America. People were speaking about him, and he was in South America. Because I had asked about him, because he had written, I think, one of the best papers in Cahiers du Cinéma under the pseudonym of Hans Lucas. Hans Jean Lucas Luc, Jean-Luc Godard. And called Défense et Illustration du Découpage Classique. And he was extensively speaking about Otto Preminger, for example. Mm-hmm. And I think the way he was speaking about découpage classique, which means actually mise en scène, filmmaking, well, it was very, very good. It's an article which should be more known than it is. And then he came back in Paris, and of course I knew already quite a few film buffs. All this group was about 6, 8, 10 years older than me, but I knew them, and so I met Jean-Luc.
Mm-hmm. And where did you hang out? Where was your center?
In theaters, you know, like the Studio Parnasse, like the MacMahon, where the picture is shot, and in near coffee shops.
The cinema MacMahon, which is where in A Bout de Souffle they go to see
exactly.
One of the films. Yeah.
Yeah. I developed a nice camaraderie with him, and I happened to know also pretty well Claude Chabrol, and I was apprentice director on Les Cousins. And I think I gave...
So it was your knowledge of film and your enthusiasm for film that they said, well, come and help with us.
Yeah, exactly.
So when you were on set, do you remember the first day on set and the work that you had to do with Belmondo, with Seberg?
The work has been very much prepared before because of the costumes, you know, and the art.
So all that style was very considered?
It wasn't. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And also the cigarette, you know, and also when Belmondo looking at Humphrey Bogart, does that on his mouth with a finger, which is something which really was requested by Jean-Luc. You know,
so he's do the Bogart impression.
Yeah, that was really, he had it in mind way before. And so what we had to do was really to get the actors in time and ready. For example, for the walk on the Champs-Élysées, as you probably know, at that time, the post office had a kind of boxers, the postmen,
yes,
were taking, you know, in this kind of big box, you know, on wheels, and they were putting the package and they were delivering them. And so I don't remember if it's Godard or Coutard who had the idea to use that box on wheels to put the camera in that, and so like that it would be hardly visible and it could be used as a traveling.
So did they borrow it? Did they steal it?
I think we borrowed it. I don't think it was a big problem. No, it was not stolen.
So they pushed Raoul Coutard along in this. That was your traveling shot. Yeah. It was this kind of rickety old kind of post office thing.
That's the way it was done.
I never knew that. It is amazing how freshness and spontaneity can kind of, you know, the mother of invention, we always say.
Absolutely.
That's one of those great iconic shots of all cinema, not just French cinema. Yeah. It kind of comes from such things. Now, I understand that Seberg herself was a bit confused by all this, because for Belmondo it was fine. He'd not done much cinema before, and he'd worked with Godard. But she had done big productions before. She was from Hollywood.
She did only two films, with Otto Preminger. I don't know if confused is the right word. Suddenly she was surprised and maybe uncertain. She was also shy about herself. She was, you know, the two pictures of Preminger, which she did also personally, I like them enormously, especially Saint Jean, even more than Bonjour Tristesse, but they were not successful and she was not well received in the films. So she was not so secure about herself. And of course, it was a totally new method, which she had not imagined. But she did pretty okay, you know. Yeah.
But that insecurity is rather attractive in the film.
Absolutely.
It's her frailty that appeals to us.
Yeah.
And Pierre, just before you go, I know we have you here because you were intimately involved in Breathless and the making of that legendary thing. But you yourself have legendary status in the world of cinema. I've seen the documentary on you by the critic Todd McCarthy, Man of Cinema. It translates L'homme du cinéma in French. And in that, there's many people like Tarantino, Scorsese, Eastwood. All kind of extolling your critical and curative and encyclopedic knowledge of film. But what there wasn't in there was any testimony about British film. So while you're here in Britain, and I know that Truffaut has often said that Britain and British and film are oxymoronic and cannot exist together, I wonder what you thought of British film.
You know, there are some British films which I like a lot, and from a long, long time back, and there are British films which I don't care for, you know, but I would say that for about any film, any national film. I don't think of a country, I think of a film, you know. I think cinema is universal, the best cinema is intemporal, and I have no prejudice, I hope, against any country, any culture, or anything.
Well, I think that we can safely say that Abu Dassouf, Breathless, belongs now to the world lexicon of cinema. It is rooted in the Champs-Élysées, but has spread out its wings to touch every single person who's ever seen a film. So, Pierre Hisson, for your involvement in that and for coming on Film Weekly today, merci beaucoup.
Thank you.
Breathless is on the run once again in selected UK cinemas from June the 25th, ahead of a DVD and Blu-ray re-release on the 13th of September. And now I'm joined by the Jean-Luc Godard of the Guardian film team, Andy Pulver. Welcome to the Film Week.
Hello. Yep. I like that.
You don't mind that, do you?
Absolutely.
It's a
compliment.
Kind of, yeah. Gnomic figure sits on high, dispensing kind of, you know, indecipherable wisdoms.
I'll do my best. Yep.
Breathless. I take it close to your heart.
You know, it's a film that however many times you see it, you can't see it enough. It's just still great.
It's very hard to see something new about Breathless.
Absolutely.
Although that is our job.
But. Yeah, the film doesn't date, though. I mean, that's what's always amazing about it, is that, obviously lots of films do, but for some reason, I think Godard's obviously just got something. I think it's the way he is clearly inventing things as he goes along that sort of makes it still seemed great, this sort of style, this very nervy style.
I just think you never know what's going to happen next in that film.
Absolutely.
I mean, it could be a long scene when they're sitting in a hotel, sort of 25 minutes, sort of, you know, flirting, and then it could be a quick scene when someone's shot. You just sort of don't know. Even though I've seen it about 8 times, and I still don't know what's going to happen.
Absolutely. I mean, he jumps around all over the place, and I think it's that improvisational quality.
But we should move on from Breathless to another person who people say has lost form and has made as many films as Goddard. This is his 39th film here. Whatever Works, it's Woody Allen. It's the meeting of Woody Allen and Larry David. You cannot get more Jewish than Whatever Works.
Jim, I have been looking for you. I want to talk to you.
Who are you?
Did you pick up a chessboard full of pieces and hit my son with it at his lesson today?
That idiot's your son? Do me a favor. Don't send that cretin to me anymore. I can't teach an empty-headed zombie chess.
I will have you know that he is a very bright child.
In your opinion.
In
your opinion, which is skewed because he's your unfortunate issue.
So you threw a chessboard at him?
I didn't throw it at him. I picked up the board and dumped the pieces on his head. As an object lesson to shake him out of his vegetable torpor.
You wait till my husband gets back from Florida.
What's he doing in Florida without you?
Punch you in the nose.
Her husband's in Fort Lauderdale. He's probably hanging out with the naked co-eds on spring break. He tells her it's a business trip. Your son's an imbecile. Teach him tiddlywinks, not chess.
Andrew, you're a Woody Allen fan. I'm a Woody Allen fan. Does this mean that one should kind of stick to one's guns and kind of support Woody whatever?
I've got to say, it is getting increasingly difficult to do that. I mean, I think you and I have fairly similar attitude to him that, you know, he is, you know, one of the all-time greats and just somebody who, you know, I mean, he is somebody who, one of the very few directors who I will make a serious effort to go and see every single film of, however terrible I kind of think it's going to be. With Larry David, it sort of promised much. I mean, I think, you know, everybody thought, well, you know, Larry David's obviously a kind of major figure at the moment and maybe he'll kind of rescue Woody Allen. And I have to say, as a film, Whatever Works isn't as bad as other Woody Allen, recent Woody Allen films that I've seen, which is saying something positive, I suppose.
He's back in New York, of course. I don't think he's been in exile. The 3 films in Britain, of which Scoop never actually came out.
What I liked about Whatever Works, actually, was actually the theme which is kind of encoded in the title, which is what, you know, occasionally Woody Allen does come up with these very interesting ideas, and he's basically saying, you know, the heart wants what it wants. If it works for you, it's great. No, you know, nobody should poke their nose into other people's emotional life. Obviously, this is a topic very close to his heart, and in some ways, you can read the film as another one of these sort of odd, slightly weird justifications of his relationship with Sun Yu, Previn, and the sort of marital difficulties that followed that.
Because Larry David plays a sort of elderly gentleman, let's call him, sort of certainly 60-something, isn't he? And he takes up with a vagrant who he offers kind of room in his flat, played by Evan Rachel Wood, who must be about 21. Well, she says she's 21. So at least there's sort of like 40 years difference between these two, and they gradually sort of fall in love and get married. And then they have this relationship in which she wanders around in her vest and pants very attractively, and he wanders around in his dressing gown and pants rather less attractively, it seems to me, as a lot of close-ups, rather too much, I thought, of Larry David's knees in this film.
Absolutely. They were knobbly and not particularly nice.
Patricia Clarkson, her mother, then comes to New York and becomes a photographer, sort of in the Annie Hall style, and then takes up to sort of has a threesome with people, and then the dad comes in, and then he becomes sort of sexually, has a sexual kind of, you know, epiphany. So at the end, there's this kind of whole gathering of them, and they're all kind of like what one might term sort of sexually adventurous or whatever, or doing something that people might kind of morally disapprove of. And he just turns to the camera and says, well, it's whatever works.
Absolutely. And there's a very good opening opening speech by Larry David, sort of basically musing on all sorts of things like that, which I think works pretty well. So for me, this is, you know, it's not awful. It's not absolutely brilliant.
That's Whatever Works, which you and I, whatever you works
yeah,
for you,
it works.
Go
it
see.
Worked.
It worked for me.
Right.
It worked as well. I thought it was funny. I kept laughing all the time. I kept thinking that the thing with Woody now is that he does do the one a year. I said, and if you don't like this one, there'll be another one along later.
You've seen the one in Cannes.
I saw the one in Cannes. You Will Meet a Tall Dark Stranger. Yeah. Which was set in London again. And I liked, but then people went, oh, it's just the old tired Woody Allen. I was like, shut up. There's some brilliant performance from Gemma Jones in there. Some of it's great. I mean, it's strange as well. It's not funny. He's much funnier when he's back in New York. The actual kind of jokes are kind of coming, bottom chick, the kind of stand-up kind of comes back. But he has got sort of a bit lazy as a director, I think. Andrew, another film out this week is Villa Amalia, which stars Isabelle Huppert, working with Benoît Jacquot for the fifth time, in which she plays a woman who strips herself of all her previous identity and goes to live on a lovely island.
Pas en train de faire une connerie là. À cause de ce que t'as vu dans ce jardin, a choisi le roi.
J'ai rien vu. Enfin, si.
C'est pas commode à notre époque de disparaître.
Je vais faire une procuration avec ton nom pour une boîte postale. Faut que mon nom
a strange film, Villa Amalia, but does centre Isabelle Huppert in practically every scene.
But I really thought this has got something. I mean, without Isabelle Huppert, I think it wouldn't have worked at all, because she has this very strange quality of sort of being very open but also completely unknowable at the same time. It was very, very odd, and it sort of suited the character, really, who is somebody who basically has a sort of meltdown in her kind of married life, and this seems to have a sort of strangely traumatic effect on the rest of her life. She quits her sort of life as a pianist, and then sort of, you know, sells everything she owns and sort of wanders off to Italy.
It's a bit of a mystery, isn't it? We don't kind of know, because right at the start she's like screaming in her car and spying on someone, and then she bumps into an old friend, and you think, and then she starts divesting all this stuff, like selling her flat, and you think, well, why? Where's it going? It's kind of gripping, and the camera just seems to sort of stick on her face, and it's as you say, it's an amazingly enigmatic face.
Absolutely, and you know, I was half expecting it to turn into a gangster film or something, but it doesn't. It just, you know, she ends up going to Italy and meeting a sort of rather good-looking Italian girl.
Wasn't she gorgeous?
Not to give anything away, but
but
that doesn't really go anywhere.
Done as well, and
it doesn't really go anywhere either. Around, you know, yeah. And but it was, I just found something compelling about it, and I said Peter obviously didn't find it particularly compelling, so you know, he's not been that generous towards it, but it just sort of confirms to me that Huppert is a very, kind of a unique figure. I mean, I actually met her here once when she came in to do a video interview, and I have to say I have never recognize somebody less, you know. I mean, you would never know her in the flesh to what she looks like on screen. I mean, absolutely unrecognizable.
But she's one of France's greatest actresses. Yeah. But how often is she doing films that are very, very small? I mean, this one, there was recently the one where she was in the film with the motorway that was built over
Home.
Home, yes, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Which was also a small, tiny little film, working with first time directors.
Yeah. I mean, she's a very interesting figure, and somebody who, as you say, you know, keeps on doing stuff that's very unusual, doesn't sort of relax or sort of get into grand dam sort of stuff at all.
And she's got this wonderful, I mean, people say about Kristin Scott Thomas, for example, who's the perfect example of the brittle bourgeoise, but I mean, Huppert is that. I mean, the ones she's done for Chabrol are just extraordinary, these
absolutely
kind of unknowable women. And it struck me here, because she was a piano, when I saw her play the piano, I thought, oh, yeah, that's Michael Haneke there.
That's danger signal.
Yeah, don't
she'll
do
be
that
hacking
again,
at herself fairly soon.
Yeah, exactly. But then I noticed that her name as a pianist in the film was Anne Hiddon.
Yes, I thought that was a bit. I thought that was slightly, you know, lumpen. But then, but also to be continuing the Jewish theme. I mean, there's a sort of big chunk of that in the film as well, where her identity as a sort of French Jew was sort of very much linked to her problems with sort of holding down her own sort of personal identity in the film. You know, she has this father who
leaves.
I mean, don't want to give away too much of the plot,
because it is a mystery as well.
It's a sort of non-dramatic mystery. But,
exactly.
So, you know, but definitely worth looking out if you have a sort of
absolutely. No, I think so. Definitely, it's a little. Yeah. I think it's a sort of undiscovered sort of gem.
Yeah.
Kind of interesting gem-ish type thing. Maybe a bit of fake jewellery. Villa Amalia, starring Isabelle Huppert. Now, this week is also a film out called Get Him to the Greek. Have you been got to the Greek yet?
Unfortunately, I've missed it.
Shall I tell you about Get Him to
please
the Greek?
Please do.
This stars Jonah Hill and Russell Brand.
Hey!
I'm Aldous Snow, the rock star.
Oh, man. I mean, your place is great. This is going to be so much fun. We're going to travel together.
Who are you, mate?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Aaron Green.
What are you doing in my house?
Oh, I'm from Pinnacle. I'm here to take you to the 10-year anniversary show at the Greek.
It's not for another 2 months.
Mum?
Yeah?
This Joker's here. It's changed the date of the Greek concert.
Why would they do that?
Why would they do that? Duffy?
Yeah?
Remember that concert in Los Angeles?
Yeah.
It's meant to be in 2 months, isn't it?
Yeah, 2 months.
2 months, right, exactly. They've changed it.
We had spoken about it.
Where are you, Russell Brand? Do you care?
I sort of think he's quite a funny stand-up. But, you know, he started out as an actor, obviously, and then went to drama school, and then sort of kind of gone beyond the sort of normal.
But what about the moral outrage that seems to have kind of banished him from this country, and we've let him now go to Hollywood, where he's now become a massive star? You know, if we weren't so morally outraged, he'd still be writing a column for us at The Guardian about football, which I never loved particularly, and doing a show on Radio 2.
I found his column pretty annoying. I mean, I say good luck to him, you know. I mean,
what
did he do? He just said something a bit rude on the radio, not like a million
people. And we went, oh, no, we don't like that. Yeah. And he went, well, all right, sod you lot, I'm going on Johnny would have been a massive star. And he really is, because in this film, he kind of carries this film as this kind of dissolute English rock star who's also a heroin addict and all that, obviously playing on his thing. But Jonah Hill is this kind of nebbishy kind of, I think, Jewish kind of, but it's unspoken in that kind of way that Woody Allen has influenced everyone, in that they're kind of any little nerds. It's from the Seth Rogen, Judd Apatow school. He goes off and he has to kind of get Russell Brand to the Greek Theatre in Los Angeles in order to that this dissolute rock star can resurrect his career. And he just plays the kind of little nerdy guy. So it's a countdown movie. It's an against the clock movie. Can he get him there without kind of all these kind of dissolute kind of things happening along the way? It should be quite exciting. You kind of think, oh, they go to New York. Oh my God, is he going to kind of get, you know, some heroin? Is he going to get arrested? Is he going to go and see his dad? All these things. Sort of that doesn't really happen though. They keep kind of cutting to loads of countdown clocks and just thinking, well, they've got hours. They're going to, you've got like a week to get there. You're going to be fine. You know, just get on a plane, you'll be fine. And they sort of do. And that gets a bit jettisoned. So it's a sort of tricksy movie in that respect. But it was very, very funny in parts in that way that I think that super bad Judd Apatow kind of movies can be. There's lots of good jokes and Russell Brand's rather sweet in it as well, as is Jonah Hill, very funny in it. Andrew Pulvert, thank you very much. Nice to see you.
Thanks a lot.
And to read all of Andy's reviews, go to guardian.co.uk/film. Well, I may have returned from Edinburgh last week, but the festival continues apace and closes on Saturday night, the 27th of June, with a British film, Third Star. The film tells of a group of young men who set off on a trip to a very wild part of the Welsh coast with the knowledge that it may be their last trip together. In the knowledge that it may be their last trip together. The film is called Third Star, and to tell me more about it, I'm joined in the studio by the film's director before she goes up to Edinburgh for her big night, Hattie Dalton. Welcome to Film Weekly.
Thank you, Jason.
Congratulations on having your first film, what you've only just finished, being accepted and made closing night gala at Edinburgh. That must have been some thrill.
Yeah, well, thrill. It was fascinating, really, because I think the nature of the beast, being a director and especially, you know, a low-budget film with problems that come with that, I was so busy focusing on all the problems of the film, just trying to solve them as my job, not being negative. I think we did a great job. But, you know, just to finish it and then literally a couple of days later find out about Edinburgh, it was awesome.
Yeah, which is, and it's very exciting to be a closing night gala. I mean, often the closing night people say, well, it's a funny sort of time. But I think there's something here that the selector, Hannah McGill, told me at the launch when she just selected. I said, oh my God, you selected Hattie's film. She goes, yes, she's really got something. I don't know if you knew her, because you've been bubbling under for a while with your BAFTA winning shorts. There's something about this film that seems to appeal to a female audience, even though it's about a group of men. There's definite sort of feminine touch to it, because you're female, yeah. Last time I looked.
That's interesting, isn't it? I think I was hoping that it would appeal to females as well, because I feel like the blokes that have seen it have said that it really is a true representation of how, you know, fellows hang out amongst each other and take the mickey out of each other, and are quite cruel and harsh, and it's all about, you know, jokes. But I think the nature of this story means that it cuts straight to the truth of emotions because of the time frame of one of these guys.
I mean, is that why you selected it to be your first feature film as a female director? It is such a kind of, you know, story of four blokes going off, and as you say, they banter and they tease each other, they rib each other, and it's about kind of rivalries and kind of almost, there's a bit of dick measuring going on.
Yeah.
Quite a lot of dick measuring going on. So why did you go, that's the script I need, that's the one for my first feature?
I love that it's all the things that are not said often, and I thought that was a really great story to be told cinematically, because it's, you know, there's a lot of dialogue that I think is written beautifully by Vaughan Saville, but it's with the acting, the characterisation is brought out in what's not said, and the tension that's growing and all of that. And I think the thing that appealed to me, as I'm British and Australian, I go back to Australia, try to every year, and there's something really poignant about every moment that I spend with precious people over there, that it's, you know, a walk on the beach isn't a walk on the beach, or a dinner isn't just a dinner, because it's the last one for a very long time. So all the nuances and all the details are really amplified. And that's what I thought was a perfect device in a
way.
Yeah,
it's funny that, isn't it? Because I have friends as well who don't see Confederate in Australia, or they come from New York, and of course they're here for 2 weeks, and then there's always that kind of, well, it's, you know, it's had his last night, and there's always a kind of, it's a last night, and well, thank God you end up going back. But there's very much that kind of sort of thing hanging over.
Yeah, it's a weight.
And it's not a spoiler, is it, of course? Because, I mean, it's kind of, that's what the film's about. Yeah. You wouldn't want to, and it's revealed in the first sort of first few minutes as well. Yeah. And so your man Benedict Cumberbatch is suffering from cancer, I think.
Yeah,
it is.
Yeah.
And so he knows that this is his last trip. How do you kind of keep that tension going if you kind of know when he's got cancer?
Yeah, well, I think there's a certain arrogance in him feeling he knows everything because he's got the wisdom of knowing that death is approaching. But actually what he discovers on the trip is that he doesn't, and he has no right to tell his friends how to live their life. He doesn't want them to have regrets that perhaps he has. But I think that interestingly, he's the one that grows the most throughout the trip. And, you know, that really interested me.
I think people get confused because you expect him to kind of say, well, because I'm dying, so I've seen into the life of things. Mm-hmm. And I can say, but he doesn't actually. He can still be dying and still be a prat, yeah, can't you?
Exactly. Total prat. And Benedict Cumberbatch's skill is to be able to walk that line between being, you know, absolutely truthful in that character, but endearing as well, because he's just really, from the heart of hearts, he wants them to live their life.
I think he's a lovely performer. I was delighted to see him have such a big part in your film.
Yeah,
as well.
The guy that plays Bill, Adam Robinson, he's fantastic as well. I mean, all of them were. J.J. Field was spot on for Miles. He that real kind of edge. I think there was a good variety of those boys. And, you know, like you said, Tom Burke, that character could have been really moany and whiny and a real martyr, but he was someone who just cared so much, and he added that extra level.
So what was it like when you were filming all these, you know, hanging out with, I mean, I don't know how many women you had on the crew, presumably, but not usually very many.
No.
It's just because crews seem to be made up of, like, so it must have been quite, the dynamic was you kind of examining this kind of coterie of men, as with your camera, probing about, kind of directing them, kind of getting caught up in their kind of, and I assume that you allowed them to improvise somewhat.
Yes. Oh no, they did some fantastic improvisation, and I think that, again, maybe the nature of, I don't want to keep saying that it was great to be shooting a low-budget film, but I'm trying to look at the positives.
Yeah, because you want a big check this time.
Yes, please. I'd like a check. Yeah. No, but the difficulties of that shoot meant that those actors were really participating as the characters in the film were. You know, it was hard yakka. They were having to do all the walking and helping with the...
So did you actually have to camp out as well? Because there are buildings and stuff. Did you kind of take a trailer into the Pembrokeshire
National Park? No, we were so isolated, but we were, you know, within probably half an hour, 40 minutes drive from B&Bs, and we were sort of spread around, and the actors all kind of stayed together, and that helped their dynamic, because I think they really stayed in character, and that was the improvisations. It was just so natural, and they, you know, having to give them space in a really ridiculous schedule, but being able to give them space just
to
do that.
Did you enjoy making this film, Hattie?
Oh, dear, is that a question I can... I think I had post-traumatic stress syndrome when I came back. I was directing in my sleep. I was looking for Carlos in my hallway cupboard one night, thinking, why isn't the camera out? If we can't get this scene, we haven't got, you know, dear me. So,
that's a good obsession, though.
Yes.
And sort of unhealthy. You need
to
compress.
No, I was nervous that was going to stay with me. But after a couple of weeks, I became relatively normal.
But do you think that the closure will then happen when you see it now, Saturday night in the Edinburgh Film Festival, kind of, oh, my God, that's what I've made, and it with an audience, I presume it'll be one of your first viewings with an audience, which will be a real different kind of experience.
Yeah. It was, I think, with a couple of little test screenings that we had, I was really blown away and heartened by mainly the emotion that people had, and I suppose without giving anything away, it was so important the last third of that film worked. And to be able to see men and women kind of quite moved and upset and probably laughing along the way and laughing at the places that I wasn't expecting were that funny as well. So that was just in the test audiences. So I can't imagine what it's going to be like in
a boozed up Saturday night Edinburgh crowd.
Yeah, exactly.
People would be falling in the aisles. You have to pick them up afterwards and peel them off the floor. And you get a party as well, which is also very nice.
Yeah.
this is where sort of the journey of the film sort of begins, another life of it. I know you've made it now. We were talking earlier about what Edinburgh is for, and I presume your film hasn't got theatrical distribution here in the UK yet. It's going to get seen at Edinburgh by critics and the like. You'll come on shows like this. I found the film very moving, actually, and I thought it was very, had a lovely lightness of touch, indeed, but also a muscularity as well. What can you hope for the film? You need it to get picked up for theatrical distribution, presumably, in Edinburgh.
Yes, please. I don't know whether, I mean, thank goodness this isn't my bag and that we have sales agent and independent and sort of got a strategy. And I think this is fabulous for us to be able to have, you know, a bit of a buzz about it and the closing. But we need theatrical release, but we're wanting to do the whole festival route. Like I said, we just finished and this is our first festival that we went for and we got in. So hopefully we'll be going to others.
Well, congratulations on it. I thought it was very, very interesting. I think you're the new Catherine Bigelow, if I may say. But I think that's because you're kind of tall, hot and kind of, you know, make films about men. Yeah. But maybe your next film will be a romantic comedy.
That's true. My shorts are there. I know. Where are the women in it?
Yeah, exactly.
Interesting. Hadn't thought of it. Yeah.
I like them too. Hattie Dalton, it is a very fine piece of work and congratulations on its position as closing night and congratulations on finishing Third Start and congratulations for coming on Film Weekly because that's even more important.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you, Jason.
And Hattie Dalton's Third Star closes the Edinburgh International Film Festival on the 27th of June. That is all for this week. Thanks to my guests, Pierre Rission and Hattie Dalton, of course. Do pick up a copy of this week's excellent new review section in The Observer, where I'm filling in for Philip French, reviewing all this week's releases, including, it should be a massive week, Woody Allen in Whatever Works, and Francis Ford Coppola with Tetro. Can you imagine, in 1975, that would have been a huge weekend. Now it's shoved under the World Cup. Who knows why? The music featured in this week's show is, of course, from Abou de Souf. It's a free jazz score by Martial Solal. From me, Jason Solomons, and Film Weekly producer Jason Phipps, until next week, au revoir, mes amis.